the difference between like strength conditioning, sports performance training, we're selecting exercises to improve a specific function as it relates to the client's goals, one, and two, the human body. So we're not just trying to get the biggest shoulders possible. We're trying to build a shoulder that allows us to throw a baseball. We're not just trying to build the biggest quads possible. We're trying to build the quads that are going to allow us to break when we plant a foot or help us run and go run that 5K or play with our kids. And so we want to think thoughtfully in our exercise selection when it comes to, I think, just general fitness and strength conditioning, because we're looking for carryover, not just hypertrophy or max load as a result.
Hi, I'm Pete McCall, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of the All About Fitness podcast. That voice you heard in the beginning is a guest for this episode, Coach Kevin Carr. Well, Kevin's a lot more than a coach. Kevin is a strength coach. He's a performance specialist. He's a licensed massage therapist. He's an entrepreneur, an author, an educator. In other words, he's another fitness professional. And what I mean by that is those of us who make a living helping half-naked people get sweaty often wear more than one hat. I do podcasts, I write, I teach, I work for a health club company. It's just the nature of what we do. Well, Kevin is a performance coach who's been working under a guy named Mike Boyle. And Mike Boyle has been on the podcast a couple times. Mike Boyle runs Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And Mike is recognized as one of the top strength coaches in the country and one of the leading experts in strength and conditioning around the world. Kevin worked for Coach Boyle for a number of years and helped Coach Boyle refine his process, and Kevin helped Coach Boyle develop the Certified Functional Strength Coach. Add that to his repertoire. So not only is he a performance coach, he's an entrepreneur. Kevin has done a little bit of everything. One of the reasons, well, the primary reason why I'm having Kevin on the podcast right now is I'm doing a series of future leaders of our industry. If you listen to All About Fitness on a regular basis, you know that I'm a veteran of the fitness industry. I've been educating personal trainers for more than 20 years. And what I'm trying to do for the next few episodes is highlight up and coming, and I shouldn't say that because Kevin is established. Kevin is an established educator, an established professional in our industry. And what I want to do is introduce him to you. But Kevin has a great way of explaining things to help you understand why you should be trained in a certain way. If you listen to All About Fitness, you know I'm biased towards training movement, meaning we train movement patterns, not just individual muscles or muscle groups. And that's what Kevin and I speak about today, because not only is he a coach, not only is he an educator, but he's an author of a great book called Functional Training and Anatomy. And if you really want to understand how your body works, A, listen to the All About Fitness podcast. Check, you're doing that right now. And B, follow Coach Carr and read Kevin's book about functional training and anatomy. It'll help you understand more about how your body is designed to function. And that's what we talk about today. On this episode of All About Fitness, Kevin and I discuss how your body works, how you should be training your body, and how you should be exercising your body based on how it works, and what that means for your personal fitness programs. Great conversation, fast-paced, a lot of information, so listen closely. Educator, author, performance coach, Kevin Carr. Today we're speaking with Kevin Carr, the author of Functional Training Anatomy. How you doing today, Kevin?
I'm doing great, Pete. How are you doing?
I am doing awesome. Now, for listeners, I heard Kevin do a webinar the other day that he gave a stat on there that absolutely blew me away. And then we're going to go into a little bit different conversation. But first, Kevin, I'm going to start off with this, because I know where you work. You're a big fan of the split leg squat.
Yep.
And yesterday you were talking a little bit about like the split leg squat comparing to the bilateral leg two-legged squat. So I'm just going to jump right into this. Can you go through and walk me through that today? Like walk me through that about the difference between a split leg squat and a standard squat?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously at MBSC, we're huge fans of unilateral approaches to lower body training. And someone who's been a big influence, especially in the last couple of years on our thought process, is Alex Natera. He's a researcher and strength coach out of Australia. He does some amazing stuff. Look him up if you can. And he's done a lot of research on, you know, comparing force production and rate of force development between single leg squats, like true single leg squats, things like single leg squats, skater squats, as well as assisted single leg squats, things like skater squats and rear elevated split squats, and comparing them with the traditional bilateral back squat, and looking at force production. What he found was very, very interesting in that someone who can do a 50% body weight external load single leg squat. So I'm a 220 pound male. If I could do a single leg squat with 110 pounds of external load, it's the same amount of force production as a double body weight back squat, right? So you think about 110 pounds of external load versus, you know, 440 pounds of external load for someone like myself with the same amount of force production. And so if you think about how that impacts trainability from day to day, the amount of external load someone has to carry to get this similar training effect. We tend to choose single leg approaches because you essentially get more for less from an efficiency standpoint. And it's usually more accessible for people and has a greater carryover to sport in everyday life. And so that's a pretty staggering stat. And he's got some research, plenty of research on that, if anyone wants to go and look that up.
Well, I thought, but the reason why I thought that was such a great thing is because I've seen more and more people doing split leg squats in regular gyms. And so you see this catching on. And really what's so cool about this is where you work, Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning, you guys really kind of rocked the ocean a number of years ago by kind of focusing only on the split leg squat. Why is it that you guys take such a focused approach to unilateral training?
I think it's easier for most people to access, even though some people might think the split position or single leg position is challenging from either a single leg strength standpoint or mobility standpoint. There's a lot of things that you have to be able to do well to back squat well with a heavy load. And when you're dealing with large groups, we're dealing with, you know, 8 to 10 athletes at a time, many with a low training age or low training history. And you try to start to put a bar on the back and teach them the back squat. It's one, it's difficult to do. And two, there's highly likelihood that people get hurt. And the number one thing we're entrusted to do from a strength and conditioning standpoint is to keep people healthy. And so we found by choosing single leg approaches, split squats, single leg squats, things of that nature, one, we were getting people really strong on one leg. And that was still providing a lot of carryover to everyday activities, running, sprinting, just moving around your daily life, because we do everything on one leg anyways. And we weren't having people that had a lot of sore backs, and we weren't seeing people get injured like we were seeing when we were having real heavy squat days sometimes. And so it was really a win-win. And when you're training a lot of people, especially athletes, pretty regularly, it becomes pretty obvious that these are the types of things we want to trend towards over the time that they're in there training with us.
Well, there are two reasons why I want to talk to you today, Kevin. One is your book, Functional Training Anatomy, which we're going to get to. But two, you're a strength coach who works primarily with athletes. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is what is it? First of all, let's talk about what a strength coach is and how that's different from a personal trainer. And then we'll go into why we should be exercising, or why we, as the average person, should be trained like an athlete. So let me ask you that. How would you describe the role of a strength and conditioning coach? And I always trip that up. I try to say strength and conditioning coach, and I trip. So how would you describe the role of a strength and conditioning coach?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. So, I mean, traditionally, you would see strength and conditioning coaches really in just team settings, right? So whether it's collegiate sports or professional sports or club sports, they would have a hired professional just to train the athletes on staff. But now, as you've seen strength and conditioning become more influential, I would say, in general fitness. Like you said, you see more people doing things like single leg squats or Olympic lifts in a general fitness setting. And you're seeing kind of more and more people seeking out personal trainers for sports performance privately. Similarly, coming to a facility like ours, which we're not a part of a sports organization, we're a private facility where anybody, people my parents' age, kids, or professional and collegiate athletes, high school athletes could come and hire us. You start to see that line blurred more between personal trainer and strength and conditioning coach, right? Because on a daily basis, although I might see Olympic athletes, professional athletes, college athletes, I also see high school kids, I see middle school kids, I see 80-year-old adults, I see 50-year-olds, I see people rehabbing a hip replacement. I literally, that was like my day today. And so that line actually becomes blurred. However, I would benefit most traditional personal trainers to, you know, try to almost emulate that idea of the strength and conditioning coach, because ultimately the most everyday people who are going to come in to train with you generally just want to feel better or improve their activities of daily living, or maybe improve their recreational sports, change their body composition. And most of them would be benefited by training more like an athlete than training like a traditional powerlifter or bodybuilder, because it's going to have greater carryover to where they want to be, greater carryover to their everyday activities. And they're typically going to feel healthier and feel better moving with more variability and variety within their workout.
Well, I mean, you and I are speaking the same language. That's the other reason why I wanted to have this conversation with you. I mean, we haven't, we've only communicated a little bit professionally, but it's always awesome to talk with somebody on the same wavelength and the same thought process, right? Because it's like you realize, oh, cool, I'm not just like making this stuff up, and there's a whole consistency out there. But why is it so, like, how would you describe the difference between the performance training, like sports conditioning, and the traditional bodybuilding? And why why should we, as the average fitness enthusiast, be looking towards that sports performance approach?
Well, it's interesting, especially in American fitness in general, we're largely influenced by the traditional strength sports, bodybuilding, powerlifting, strongman, Olympic lifting, things of that nature. Things that are where the goal is either to move and lift as much weight as possible, or in bodybuilding's case, to put on as much muscle as possible. Right? Those are the two pretty simple goals. And so the tools that they use are going to reflect that, right? The more traditional tools for things like powerlifting, Olympic lifting, very bilateral approaches, squatting, deadlifting, bench pressing, the Olympic lifts. For powerlifting, I mean, for bodybuilding rather, it's going to be a lot of machine-based training. And the reason they choose, you know, machine-based training primarily in bodybuilding is because it allows the least variability of movement while we're lifting, so we can drive as much metabolic stress and hypertrophy into the muscles as possible, because you're just trying to add muscle, not necessarily trying to improve function or carry over to the things you're doing in everyday life. Sent me packing. What we do with the internship is, like, you have to work out in a group 4 days a week when you're there, because it's experiential as well as your coaching. And so I learned how to train. I saw things were challenging for me that I thought I was strong, or I thought I was fit, and I couldn't, you know, run shuttles with everybody else, or I was really weak on one leg. I specifically remember that. And I saw a lot of shortcomings in myself. And I kind of, with that summer, the like 12 weeks I was there, really, it was complete mind changing for me. Like, I was bought in by the end of it, because it was going through the process was really a huge eye opener.
And it's interesting you say that, because I didn't go through an internship. It was the year 2000. I was a relatively new trainer. I volunteered for something with a Juan Carlos Santana lecture at a conference, and he put me through a 2-minute grinder he called the dumbbell lunge and reach matrix. I'm sure you've seen different versions of it, but it really, that's what blew my mind, Kevin, where it's like, I'm not training the right way. You know, this whole approach of like bodybuilding, chest one day, back another day, really just doesn't work with how our body's designed. How do you explain that? When somebody comes to you and says, hey, why aren't we doing these type of muscle exercises, or why aren't we doing these exercises I read about in this magazine? How do you explain that to those clients or to those customers?
Yeah. And so two things. One, like you said, like, we pretty much are doing more of a full body approach when people come in. We're not necessarily having a chest day or a back day or a leg day. And one, most people's frequency when they come to see us in a gym, like, I understand maybe why a bodybuilder might do that if they're training 6 days a week and they want to spread the stress out. But the majority of people that come to train with you are coming 2 days a week on average. The average personal training client comes 2 days a week. And so you can't really do a chest day and a leg day, because then you just don't train with enough frequency. Whereas I tell people, like, listen, if you come in 2 days a week and we do full body exercises both times you come in, then we tend to get the most efficiency out of your time where you're with me. So we can get more frequency and exposure. And additionally, the reason why we train full body is because you're trying to develop your entire body. I'm not looking at it in segments. I'm looking at it as an entire piece that's working together, and we can develop it all concurrently. I like the phrase Mike kind of coined, is like, with training, it's a recipe, not a menu. Mm. You don't get to just pick what you want. Yes, you might have goals or things we want to work towards, and we're going to tailor our programming towards those. But in general, we're looking to develop your physicality as a whole. And that's where people are going to get the most benefit for their overall health, as well as probably how they look if they buy into kind of what you're doing.
And what do you hear when you talk to clients? I'm not just thinking about the teenage athletes, because your organization works with a lot of younger athletes. But when we're talking about guys like our age between their 30s and 50s, mm-hmm. What's their feedback when they come in and start working with you like that? What do you hear from them? Well, not me, just guys. I mean, people between 30s and 50s. So sorry, I just want to be, I gotta be clear about that.
Yeah. So, well, it's funny, the two things. One, when you do get guys who are kind of middle-aged maybe, and they have a history of lifting before that, maybe they kind of fell off and they want to get back into shape. One, getting them to understand, listen, we're not trying to go as heavy as possible every time you come in here. I'm trying to teach you how to be a good lifter first. I'm trying to teach you how to train first. And first and foremost, I want you to be healthy. And so, you know, it's like, we're not going to start, you know, with heavy squats or heavy bench on day one. I'm going to, you know, make sure you know how to push up. I'm going to make sure you know how to goblet squat. I'm going to make sure you know how to do all the fundamental things. And we're going to train full body concurrently. Again, we're not going to have like a big chest day on Monday when you show up. And then another thing, I think that we often see with people is, you know, where training is a long process. Another kind of Mike Boyleism is like training is like farming. you know, you can't grow crops overnight. But most people, when they come in to train, want training overnight. Right. But it doesn't work that way. And most people, when you try to come out of the gates too aggressively, the training experience tends to be short lived. They get burnt out, they get injured. They're sore. I always tell people, when you leave here, especially the first couple weeks, I just want you to feel really good. Maybe you felt like you did a little something, but I don't want you to get up the next day and think that you can't get out of the chair. And so we want to take slow, progressive steps forward. If you tell me the first week that, hey, I think that was too easy, then I probably did a good job. If you tell me that, hey, you think it was too hard or you're really sore, I probably did too much.
And oh, so that's part of, I'm going to cut in there, Kevin, because I want to hold on to that because I really think, let's dial in on that, because that's one of the things I've always had to coach clients on is like soreness is not necessarily what we're going after. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, really, how should out of a good, say you're putting me through a good movement based workout, how should I feel? Like in your description, what should I feel like afterwards?
Generally, I think you should feel a little energized. You maybe be a little tired and feel like you worked, but I don't want you to feel like you're cramping up. I don't want you to feel like you're achy and sore. I don't want you to feel like you're going to throw up. But unfortunately, those are a lot of the sensations that general population people associate with good exercise, right? There's a quote something I said a while back where I said, like, one of the biggest misconceptions in fitness is that good exercise equals being sweaty, sore, tired, and exhausted down for workout. That's probably the biggest misconception in fitness as it comes to general population, because the things that they see in TV, the way they see it advertised, promotes that idea. But in general, we know we can consistently get people better with just giving them enough stress in that training session to allow for an improvement, and then slowly increasing that amount of stress that they're exposed to over years. What people see when they see people who are really good in shape is a finished product, right? Like you've been working out for how many years? 20 something years, 30 years,
34, yeah, 30 or 35 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like 15, 16.
Exactly. And so what they see with you or what they see with myself or, at these professional athletes is they see the culmination of a progressive growth of that individual over years. You're not going to start where they are. And so getting them to understand that, and again, that's a conversation I have with clients all the time is, listen, you have to look at this as a long-term investment to where we're going. It's like compounding interest. And if you buy into it that way, you're going to have a really good result, you know, years down the road, but you have to look at it that way. You can't save all the money overnight.
Honestly, I'm going to just do a mic drop and we're going to end it right here because, that's such an important message. And I hadn't heard that micism before of that we're generating a farm. But that is actually appropriate because you're going to have to take time off, right? If you're farming correctly, you don't plant the fields every year and you rotate them through. Just like with training, you don't always do high intensity exercise. So how do you guys structure in that recovery? Like, how do you guys build recovery into your programs?
Yeah. And so I think it starts first by looking at your exercise selection and your pairings. If you want to get a really high intensity effort, which is appropriate at times, you have to allow an equally low intensity recovery period for someone to be able to recover from that. So for instance, we do high velocity sprinting. I had a bunch of high school kids doing max effort sprints today through the timers, about as high intensity work as it gets when you're in there. They're doing a max sprint for about 30 yards as hard as they can. From a nervous system taxing standpoint, it's through the roof, right? But because of that, they're going to need a few minutes rest before they have to go into another one. I can't just tell them, hey, jog back and go again. But that's what like a high school football coach might have them do, right? They just try to make them tired. It's not a great way to make them faster. It's probably a great way to get them hurt. Equally with my adults today, we did bike sprints at the end for conditioning, right? And I said to them, however long it takes you to do it, I want you to rest 2.5 to 3 times that. That's really hard for them. Seeing them sit on the bike, they're like, can I go yet? I'm like, no, you can't.
I used to do that in cycling classes. I would teach indoor cycling, Kevin. And I'm like, let's do an all out sprint for 30 seconds, but we're going to take 90 seconds off. Even though I know, like, and look, I give them a 30 second sprint knowing that the first 3 to 5 seconds is junk. And so they're really maybe getting 20 seconds of pure high intensity effort. And then they look at me like, when's the next one? I'm like, well, we're taking 90 to 120 seconds of rest, right? Yeah. I mean, how do you coach people through the appropriate rest and the appropriate recovery? What's your approach to coaching people that this is important?
Two things. One, we heart rate monitor everybody. Most of the adults, we really encourage them. We have a MyZone system with the TVs so they can get some visual feedback. So they can see the cardiovascular numbers and they can start to understand, hey, I want you down below 60% or whatever, if we're going to go heart rate based. But also I'm telling them that like, if the intensity is high, the quality has to be high. And so it can be very easy to do a bunch of 70, 75% effort sprints and not have a lot of rest, but you're not going to be giving me a 100% effort or even 90% effort if you're not resting in an adequate amount of time and letting them starting to again focus on quality of effort, not quantity of effort, becomes really important. And some people, that's a quick understanding. They get that very easily. But there's some people, if they're really conditioned to like metabolically driven workouts, and there's a lot of, you know, approaches to fitness out there that really try to stress getting people's heart rate up and keeping it up and short rest periods. If they've had a history of doing that, there's more unlearning that they have to do. And as a coach, one thing I always tell our coaches at MBSC to ask on an intake interview is, what are some of your previous experiences with exercise? That's exactly how I quote it. So that they can say to me what it is that they've done in the past. I don't say, what do you do for workouts? I say, what are some of your previous experiences with exercise? Because it's going to make them have a long form answer. And then I can ask follow-ups. And if they start to tell me, hey, you know, I do a lot of metabolic conditioning, I go to these classes, I can start to already feed in the education for them about how we're going to go about doing things. Because typically when someone comes to you, they probably have some past experiences or past beliefs about how exercise should be done. And so if you can start to understand where they're at, you can start to help them unlearn it or bring it to the direction that you want.
Hmm. Now, that's a great approach. And you guys work primarily with athletes. And what I would always do in a big box gym, Kevin, when I was training full time, is I would tell my clients, look, I'm training you like an athlete. It doesn't mean I'm doing the same volume and intensity. I'm just taking the same methodology because I want them focused. I want them focused when they train. I want them at 100% effort. But when they're not doing it, I want them resting and recovering and being able to take that mindset. Do your regular clients start adopting that athletic approach and start adopting that athletic mindset? And do you see a change in them as they stay with you for a period of time? And I mean, just in terms of their overall mentality, in terms of how they approach conditioning.
Yeah, I think I do think so. And I think the environment certainly helps us. It's a very sports-driven atmosphere that we're in. When you walk in, there's jerseys on the wall, pictures of athletes on the wall. And our general population clientele, like my adult group at 6:45 in the morning, that has, you know, 10, 12 adults in it who are, you know, 30 to 75. They're training right alongside the professional hockey guys. Like Mike's group is going on at the same time with all the NHL guys. So they start to see themselves doing similar exercises. Like they're all doing split squats today. You know, they're all doing push-ups. They're all doing rows. They're all on the bike at the same time. And so when they see them training that way, they start to emulate the way they do things. They start to carry themselves the way that they do things. And so part of it's the environment that you create sometimes as well, because you start to act like the tribe of the people who are around you.
And that's such a cool thing. I mean, look, I'm a big gym geek. I love the gym. Obviously, I work for a big box health club company, but there is something about having that environment. Because we know the thing that gets people coming back to fitness, Kevin, is the way it makes them feel. And having the exercise, honestly, one of the things I think that's so cool about your facility is the exercise is cool, but it's more of the community. I think Mike has done a phenomenal job. How would you describe the, I mean, do you see that community? And do you think community is an important part of what we do in fitness?
1,000%, because in general, everybody knows kind of what they should be doing. I'm not saying everyone can build a program, but everyone knows they should be exercising. Everyone knows they should be eating vegetables. Everybody knows they should be getting sleep. But what gets people to adhere to behaviors is a belief around those activities being meaningful and those activities being part of a community, right? This is what we do. Right. And so, you know, when you're in a group of people and you identify with a group of people, you're going to start to mirror and follow their behaviors, whether that's positive or negative. Right. You can go back to when you were a kid and your mom or dad said, hey, I don't want you hanging around those group of kids because you're going to get into trouble. And lo and behold, you hang out with them and eventually you get into trouble. Right. It's a story as old as time. But from a positive aspect standpoint, too, you know, we've had a lot of kids who come to us at MBSC and find a lot of positivity in being there every day. So much so that you might have a kid who kind of was off to a rocky start in high school and they get into strength conditioning, play a college sport, they come back and they work for us. I've seen that happen multiple times because they like the environment. Similarly for adults, you get some people who don't identify with fitness. For them, they came to us maybe because they had an injury or they kind of got really out of shape and they had to exercise kind of begrudgingly. And then all of a sudden, they're in a community of people in their group every day who they talk to, they become their friends. It keeps them consistent. They change their behaviors. They change their social patterns. And all of a sudden their whole identity changes around fitness. And you see this happen all the time because people find some sort of positivity in that community and that, you know, the idea of having a tribe. Right. And so I think there's a lot of power in how you kind of create your environment and your culture as far as how it impacts your clients.
And see, that's what we're really – everything that I've always looked at. The funny thing, Kevin, was when I used to be a full-time fitness instructor, you would see classes like group fitness classes kind of coalesce. And then all of a sudden, they're going to happy hours. They're doing birthday parties together. You look at what we do, man. I mean, we don't just make people sweaty, but we really create an environment where people will – we create positive energy. Now, I want to shift gears a little bit because we've talked a little bit about performance training. We've talked a little bit about bodybuilding. And I want to talk about your book, Functional Training Anatomy, and why did you write it, Kevin? What was the motivation for writing the book?
Well, it's interesting. So talking with the people at Human Kinetics who published it, we had a few different things we were kicking around. But what I really wanted was something that went really well with our Certified Functional Strength Coach course. And so if you look at the book, it really is a kind of an anatomical guide and explanation of all of the things that we teach. A lot of the basic exercise progressions we go through in CFSE are laid out from an anatomical illustration and explanation standpoint in the text. And so I think that, you know, I wanted to have something that I thought really accompanied the curriculum and course that I teach all the time. And I also wanted a textbook that gave a foundation to the way that we train, because I think a lot of times people ask for an anatomy book, but they don't necessarily get a training in anatomy book. They get an anatomy book or they get a training book. And this, I thought, bridged the gap really well between anatomy and what we actually do on the floor every day with our programming. And I was really, really pleased with how it all came together.
And who was your big influence in studying anatomy? Like, where did you, and then I want to talk because I think, What we're going to go into is going to really surprise some people that they're training their muscles wrong, right? Because that's one thing that we learn like really how our muscles work, is we realize that a lot of the traditional gym exercises aren't using the muscles the way they're designed to actually function. So where did you learn? Like, what was your big influence as you're learning anatomy and biomechanics?
Yeah, I mean, so I had a traditional background like most people. When I went to university, I went to the University of Massachusetts. I have a degree in kinesiology. So I got the basis of gross anatomy. I got the basis of biomechanics there. But I really learned how that related to training when I became a strength conditioning coach. I started working with people at MBSC. And then I got into kind of a rehab-based setting working at Movement is Medicine, where I'm also a massage therapist. And so when I started to look for solutions to someone having a hamstring strain, you know, someone rehabbing a knee injury, someone rehabbing a shoulder injury, I had to start to dig deep. One, I have obviously a great mentor and resource out of Mike Boyle. Obviously, it's been a huge impact on me. But within the entire fitness world, people like Gray Cook, and Lee Burton from Functional Movement Systems were hugely helpful. Tom Michaud, he's based out of Boston, actually. He's, I think, a podiatrist by trade, has some great books on human locomotion, were hugely helpful for me. And so, you know, I mean, our whole industry as a whole is a ton of resources that I've kind of group sourced for me to try to help my thought process on how to go about our best exercise selection to solve problems, right? And so in searching to solve problems for myself in the training environment, I kind of found my philosophy that way.
And like, let's take a look. Let's use, because you used the example of hamstrings. Mm-hmm. And real quick, I forgot you're an LMT, man. You said that the other day, and I completely forgot you're a massage therapist. Mm-hmm. So of course, as a massage therapist, you're going to dive deep, deep into anatomy. So before mm-hmm. I ask the next question, why did you decide to become an LMT, and how did that influence your training career?
Yeah. So, I mean, initially when I went to school for kinesiology, I originally thought maybe I'll go and become a physical therapist. Right. And then I discovered strength conditioning during my freshman year of college, you know, with Mike. And I really had a passion for the training piece at that point. And I said, you know what, I really want to be a strength conditioning coach, but I still wanted to help people with injuries. And I saw high demand for people to receive manual therapy and soft tissue work. Mm. And we have a great physical therapist who's been on staff at MBSC since the first day I walked in there, John Paloff. Many people are probably familiar with the Paloff press. Mm. That is the man. He's still right there. Okay. But like, there was a high demand also for people to just receive manual therapy. And Brendan Rerick, my business partner at the time too, we had said, like, I wonder if we could start a business where we could provide people manual therapy and help get them back to exercise. I knew that I didn't necessarily want to be in a traditional physical therapy setting. I didn't want to be a physical therapist. I didn't want to deal with immediate acute care. I'd let people deal with things that were in that scope. I wanted to deal with chronic issues, people with soft tissue issues, and then help get them exercising again. Because I saw how powerful good strength and conditioning was for rehabbing injuries and getting people to feel better. And so what I did is Brendan and I, we went to massage school. There was a massage school, Cortiva Institute, that was in Boston. And we would do, you know, Monday, Wednesday nights from 6 to 10 and then Saturdays. And we would kind of do that while still working at the gym, and then came around and were able to open up our massage business shortly thereafter. And that has turned into a good adjunct business for me and a good service for the people that come to our gym, because I'm located, I rent space out of MBSC to run that business as well.
Dude, I need to have an offline conversation, because you seem to have a few different revenue streams here, and I need to, I might need to get a few pointers from you. Might need to get a few ideas from you. But what I like about that, Kevin, the way you described that, is for years, man, I've been telling trainers that will say that I want to go become a physical therapist. I'm like, don't go get an LMT, go become a licensed massage therapist, because as a massage therapist, you can manipulate tissue and you can help people mm-hmm. move better immediately. And personal trainers who are massage therapists, I think, are probably the most dangerous weapons. And I mean that, and like, or strength coaches with massage mm-hmm. therapy are the most dangerous weapons. Now, to wrap up here, as we get ready to finish the conversation, let's talk a little bit about how our muscles actually function and a couple ways that people might not be using those muscles correctly. And you're talking about the hamstrings. And I was laughing mm-hmm. during the webinar, but I've been using that same example for about 15 years now, because I always look at injury reports in July and August. I always look at NFL injury reports, because I know. So talk about that. I'll let you talk about that, because you did such a great job. But for years I've said that if you want to see what teams don't condition well, LA Chargers, if you want to see what teams don't do it right, look at the injury reports. So what were you talking about with the hamstrings?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's probably no surprise to most people that, you know, hamstring strains are the most common soft tissue injury in all sports. And if you're looking in, you know, August and September on the NFL injury list, like you said, you're going to see a whole rash of hamstring strains, especially early in the preseason. And hamstring strains really come as a result of two things. If they're, you know, non-contact related, they're not falling into a split on the ground. What you realize is the traditional way that people want to train their hamstrings. You say, how are you going to train your hamstrings? People say, I'm going to do a supine or a seated leg curl on a machine. And yes, you will be working your hamstring. Your hamstring will be working to flex your knee in that context. However, that's not really how a hamstring functions when we're running in gait. Your hamstring can flex your knee in an isolated position. But if we're looking to have carryover to running, we have to think about what a hamstring does while we run. And so what a hamstring does while we run, when we look at the research is it acts as an assistance in hip extension along with the glutes. It helps us extend our hip and propel ourselves forward. It helps to break the deceleration of knee extension before our foot hits the ground. So it's working eccentrically to slow down the tibia coming forward. And it's helping to maintain sagittal plane position of our pelvis, kind of as an isometric or eccentric controller of pelvic motion. Notice I didn't say it works as a concentric knee flexor, as most people would traditionally train it. That's way down on the list as far as when you see EMG activity, how it's being used in the gait cycle. And so what happens is we need to choose exercises that focus on hip extension, eccentric knee extension, as well as isometric and eccentric control of the pelvis. And so exercises like Nordics or sliding leg curls, single leg deadlifts can be really good options that have carryover to running. Isolated leg curl machine, not so much. And so I think one half of the equation is we're just not kind of training them correctly in the weight room for the most carryover towards sprinting, which is where you see the hamstring strains happen. And then secondarily, people aren't sprinting in the off season. And then when they go to sprint when the season starts, they're not conditioned to the high velocities of contraction rates, really high velocity contraction rates that go on during sprinting in like a game-like condition. You see a lot of athletes maybe running at 75 to 85% in practice in preseason, and then they get into a game and they run at 100 or 105%, and they haven't run at 105% since last season. And so what are you going to see happen there in a game-like condition when the adrenaline's pumping, the cortisol's going, they're about to make a play, and they take off, is that foot strikes the ground and that hamstring blows up because it hasn't seen those type of forces, is not ready for that to happen. And so it is usually kind of indicative of preparation very often when you see those, because in my mind, we see very little hamstring strains out of our athletes once they've trained us for a while. Like, I'm not going to say it's preventable, but I understand how ACL injuries happen and some of these ground contact injuries happen. Hamstring strains to me seem like something that we can start to really reduce the instances of if we're really thinking about how we go about training.
And the other thing is too, let's talk a little bit about the rectus abdominis. We'll finish up with this because we know the most common quote unquote core exercise or what traditionally was is just laying on your back and doing those trunk curls. And the way I've always taught in anatomy, Kevin, is we have to understand how muscles function during gait. I mean, that's what I learned from Gary's whole fellowship is we have to contextualize muscle function in gait because that's how our body is designed to move. And the way I've described this for a year, do you have kids?
Yeah.
Okay.
One.
So, how old?
Not old enough to walk yet. 4 months.
Dude, seriously, how many months?
4 months.
Now is the time. Do you record? Because I have videos.
I've more videos of this kid in the last 4 months than I could ever imagine.
I mean, my ex doesn't really like me using them for teaching, but I use the motor pattern development because the way I describe it, Kevin, is that after having two kids, the first year of life is a strength and conditioning program to be able to walk from tummy time to rolling over to crawling to cruising. Everything that they do, so your kid is 4 months into his macro cycle to be able to walk at about 12 to 13 months. Yeah. And what I used to always do to my especially my younger daughter, she's very active. Every time she would crawl, I'd pick her up and put her over on her back so she'd have to roll over and use. And that's how I would do my core training with Mike. Anyway, it's cool to hear you're in that because you get to learn that. But talk about let's go into the rectus abdominis because a lot of people train it in the way it doesn't actually function. How would you describe strengthening the rectus abdominis, or how should we?
Yeah. And so for the trunk muscles in general, you see a lot of misunderstanding is because once again, the approach for some reason to training core muscles or the trunk muscles is a lot of really high volume repetitive motion, right? So if it's rectus abdominis, it's high, it's never like three sets of 10, right? It's like three sets of 25 repeated flexion or, you know, three sets of 25 Russian twist side to side. So there's always a lot of either flexion, extension, rotation being driven at the joints at high volumes. So right off the bat, especially for someone who's a beginner, tends to be problematic, especially if they don't have the adequate joint ranges of motion at those segments to do those exercises. From a functionality standpoint, if you think about how the trunk muscles work, they're often helping transfer force between the lower and upper body. It serves as like a connecting point for when we push off the ground and want to deliver force into our hands or vice versa. So what it really works as an eccentric and isometric controller of trunk motion. right? If you go to swing a golf club, you don't just swing as hard as you can and hope that you hit the ball. You want to control that motion and stay over the ball and over your hips to hit the ball and drive the direction you want to go, right? And so in doing that, we want to think about selecting exercises that teach us how to control the position of our rib cage and control the position of the pelvis in relation to one another. So rather than thinking about doing, you know, a bunch of repetitive crunches, doing things that are anti-based core training, we tend to take approaches like anti-extension, anti-rotation, anti-lateral flexion, where we're resisting motion or controlling motion, and using our muscles at our abdominals more as eccentric and isometric controllers of motion, as opposed to repetitive concentric creators of motion.
And see, that's just what a lot of people don't realize, is they don't realize the scope of how we need to integrate everything together. Well, I think that's awesome. I mean, your book, Functional Training Anatomy, will cover that. So for listeners, if you want to learn more about how your body functions, and let's be honest, Kevin, the way you should be training your body, right? I mean, that's the book to pick up. Do you have anything, what else you got planned coming up with Mike Bowe's Strength and Conditioning and Movement is Medicine? You got any projects in the work or anything you want to talk about?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I have a course coming out to accompany the book. An online course should be coming out hopefully in the next week or so. I've been working on it. I partnered up with Muscle in Motion.
Okay.
So if you're familiar with Muscle in Motion, they do those amazing anatomical video illustrations on YouTube primarily. They have Instagram as well, of different exercises. And so what we did is we created kind of an online course to kind of go into some of the topics and go into practical examples in the book. And what we did is I have lectures, exercise demos, instructions where they put in videos with the anatomy going through the motions of those exercises and the explanations. And so that should be coming out hopefully in the next week or so. We're kind of putting some final touches on there. So that's really exciting. It'll be a good accompaniment to the book. That's going to be available through CFSC. And then, you know, what else through CFSC is we just have a lot of courses coming up, like all over the country, all over the world, really. I'm going to be in Budapest next week, teaching for 3 days. I know we have one in Arizona coming up the start of November, but if you head to certifiedfsc.com, you can see the whole list of everything we have coming up down the pipeline.
And for listeners, and now I'll be describing this in the intro and whatnot, that's a certified functional strength coach. And man, that's one of the things you guys came out with that. I'm like, I did it the hard way. I went to all Mike's lectures. I read his books. I had a cobble. I spent like 5 to 7 years going collecting all this information and putting together the system. And you guys came up and developed the whole certification. So
us
old guys were a little bit behind the curve, but I think that's what's so cool about it. Well, yeah. Kevin Carr, you're one of the creators of the certified functional strength coach certification. I'm going to have a link down below. I'm going to have a link to your book, Functional Training Anatomy. You're with Mike Boyle Strength and Conditioning. You have Movement is Medicine in Boston. You're that next generation. I mean, like I said, we're a few years apart, but I'm looking forward to seeing what you keep doing because you're rocking and rolling, and it's going to be fun to watch how you keep things moving. So thank you for your time, Kevin. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Pete. I really appreciate it.
Now, that's a fun conversation, and I say that quite a bit. I started this podcast selfishly. I mean that 100%. I started this podcast selfishly. Now, there'll be information down below in the show notes. If you want to get Kevin's information, you have that. I've written an ebook on functional training anatomy. My ebook is on dynamic. I call it dynamic anatomy. Very similar to the information in Kevin's book, Functional Training Anatomy. The resources are different, each one. But the main thing is you're hearing different experts. And that's why I wanted to have Kevin on. Recently, I reran a podcast from Greg Cook, and it is great that Kevin referenced Greg Cook. I reran a podcast from Gary Gray. These are some of the founding leaders in our industry, and one of the reasons why I wanted to speak with Kevin is that next generation. You had Greg Cook, you had Mike Boyle. Kevin's boss, who Kevin's worked with very closely, is actually good friends with Greg Cook and helped Gray and Lee develop the functional movement screen and put it into place and practice it and help it be accepted. So what I've been doing on the podcast, even though I've been running some reruns, what I want you to hear about is that transition between those innovators, those leaders in our industry who got us thinking a different way, who had us training differently than we had before. And now Kevin's one of the first ones of the next generation. And you're going to be hearing from a few others in upcoming episodes. Kevin's that next generation who understands fitness but has modified it to the 21st century by having education courses online, by doing online coaching, but by also being in person. Hey, fascinating conversation. I wanted to, as I've been reading Smarter Workouts, as I've been relaunching the podcast after taking a break, what I want to do is help you understand how you should be exercising. And I'm not just saying that because it's the way I do it. I do it because of I've spent 20, 25 years studying exercise science. I train this way. I train a certain way because it's what the evidence shows us. It's what the evidence suggests is the most effective way to train. And that's what I try to bring to you through the podcast, through my books. If you want to get more information, you can pick up Smarter Workouts, The Science of Exercise Made Simple. It's a great companion. In fact, one of the reasons why I interviewed Kevin is our books are often featured together on Amazon. If you look for Smarter Workouts or you look for Ageless Intensity on Amazon, you're going to see Kevin's book come up as well. And we write about similar content, so I want to be able to feature an author who's going to help you think the same way about how you should exercise. You can find Kevin Carr online. You have information about how to contact him. Hey, you can always track me down. Reach out to Pete at PeteMcCallFitness.com. That's Pete at PeteMcCallFitness.com. And as always, thanks for stopping by. And I do look forward to having you join me for future episodes of All About Fitness.